Here we go.
Welcome to BP Wrigleycast, the show that is victorious and spikes the football and is enjoying ourselves probably way too much. I'm your host, Ryan Davis. Tonight we are missing Carlos, but I have Isaac Bennett, or Isaac Davis, which he prefers to be called, and Joel Reese. Gentlemen, welcome.
Hey, good to be here, huh?
Oh, man. Yeah. It's good to be here. Yes.
All right, so I wanted to open a little bit with my short take on my experience last night, which was when the evening which the Cubs won the National League pennant.
Yeah, let's get that out there right away.
Yeah, so I was supposed to be at a wedding in Schaumburg, and this is something I think I told Isaac like a long time ago, just kind of throwing it out there, like, well, if the Cubs are in the NLCS. And if they advance to game six, whatever is happening on that night, I'm going to be at a wedding. And so here we were rolling into it. And, you know, without pulling any punches, I'll just say I was supposed to be doing player analysis, like player report cards for The Athletic. And I absolutely had to be watching that game. So what I came to find out was the reception I was going to be at did not have a cable hookup.
But were you were in Schaumburg, not like Siberia?
Yeah, pretty much. So at this point, I'm like, look, there's just no way I can be there. So I went to the actual wedding in the afternoon, and then my wife and my daughter went to the reception and had their delicious steak dinner and hung out with family and danced in more fancy clothes. And I wore sweatpants in a Schaumburg hotel room and took notes on the game and jumped up and down in my hotel room by myself with my cold Chinese food and enjoyed myself. So that's how I experienced this once in a lifetime thing. Isaac, let's go to you and find, how did you experience it?
Well, yeah, it is. It was a scintillating story. I had four tickets to the game that I just won through the Cubs lottery playoff system, and I had sold two of them very early on to recoup my what I had spent on them. I recouped it and more. And then I had to decide to do what to do with the last two. As everybody on this podcast knows, my wife is a diehard Cardinals fan, and she, I don't know if I would say she didn't have much interest in going, but I will just say that it was kind of a waste of money to take her with me, as callous as that sounds. And she kind of acknowledged that as well. And all of my brothers are out of town. They live out of town, and none of them could come back for the game. So I kind of had a lot of, I guess I stressed about the decision what to do with them. And yesterday morning, I went ahead and lowered the price on StubHub enough to get them sold and stay home. So I think that actually ended up being the right decision for me. I live about 3 hours from Chicago, and I was surrounded by about 15 family members for a watch party last night. And, you know, it was one of those things where I just felt like I was kind of at home in the way that I experienced the Cubs, which was with the TV muted for part of it, listening to Ron and Pat and surrounded by family and tweeting with my friends online. And I just found that it was everything that I could have hoped it would be. And it was a seminal moment in my life, and I think for many others. And I was sort of overwhelmed by the amount of text messages and just Twitter messages and things like that from people, you know, just reaching out to say, hey, I love you. This is great. Glad we're experiencing this together. And it is a day that I will never, ever forget. So just surrounded by family and couldn't have been any happier.
Wow, that sounds great. That's really cool. You know, Ryan, I was thinking the only thing that would make your story better, I love the detail about the cold Chinese food. The only thing that would make it better is if you were wearing Zubas. That would really just complete the picture in my mind.
No, my old beat up sweatpants and a t-shirt and no socks.
Okay.
Right. Yeah. It was a very big moment for me in my choice of wardrobe.
Sartorially speaking.
We're still talking about baseball here.
Dressed as a writer, really. That's what I was doing.
So, okay. Yeah. Let me tell my story real quick and then we can get into it. I was at the game. I'm in a season ticket package. This was my one playoff game that I was able to go to. I didn't do too well in the lottery. So the game ended and I had pretty good seats, aisle 228, and the game was ending and, you know, you're watching the presentation and, you know, the players and Tom Ricketts and stuff. And it's like, okay, well, what am I going to do? Am I going to stay here and watch this up here? And I was going to leave. And then I texted a friend. He said, well, we're down by the Cubs dugout. I was like, okay, well, I'll head down there. So I went down there and I ended up on the, I guess the north side of the dugout, you know, more toward the outfield. And I ended up in the front row and I was kind of close to where Dan Plesac was interviewing people. So I was kind of standing there and watching that. I was like, this is kind of cool, you know, and Chris Bryant was, I don't know, 15, 20 feet away and Dexter Fowler. And then Wilson Contreras came out of the dugout about 20 feet away from me. And he was like shaking hands and whatever. And then he was taking selfies with people. And he was doing it. Like he took their phone and then would, you know, hold it out and take the picture with them. So I was like, wow, that's so cool. He's doing that. And he did a couple. And I was like, oh, that's nice. And I didn't think that I would participate in this. I'm, you know, a middle-aged guy. Like that's okay. It's not, it didn't really, it wasn't life or death for me that I get this, but he kept coming closer. And then I moved a little closer and then he was there in front of me. And I'm like, oh shit. Well, here's Wilson. Here's my phone. And he took a photo of me, of us together, me and Wilson Contreras. And it's like one of the best pictures of me that I've ever taken in my life. Cause I look absolutely euphoric and I put it on Facebook and it's gotten 300 likes, which is the most of anything I've ever posted. Like, not when, like, I don't think I was on Facebook when my daughter was born. I may have been when we bought our house, my daughter's birthdays, whatever. Nothing has come close to this. So this was like, and I look at that picture and I'm going to be honest here because I know it's just us three talking and no one's listening. I get teared up when I look at it because I look at myself and I see someone who's so happy. And behind me, the people are so happy. They're just euphoric and everyone's just smiling with their faces just lit up. And it was just, it was amazing. So I just kind of lucked into this great thing. So it was a perfect way to end this perfect night. Mm.
I have to admit, when I saw your picture, well, first of all, I was a little jealous, not because you're taking a picture with Wilson Contreras, but just because you're there and you're in that position. And it also felt like these two things that I know that for some reason are together and I can't figure out why. Like,
yeah,
I don't know. It felt like one had to be photoshopped in.
Yeah, it looked photoshopped. Yeah,
yeah. I mean, it turned out so perfectly. He framed it like, perfectly.
Yeah, exactly. I'm not saying like, I'm just saying that the feel was that like it had to have been photoshopped. Not necessarily that I thought like, you know, oh, that's fake. But yeah, it just the whole like two worlds colliding, like seeing Joel, my podcast buddy, and Wilson Contreras wearing his like champagne spray goggles,
yeah,
like in the same picture. It just seemed, it was really cool. I'm very happy for you that you got to experience.
Yeah,
that.
It was really awesome. I mean, and again, I didn't seek it out. I'm not like, you know, someone to go and get autographs or whatever, but it was like, it just kind of happened. And there he was. And I stuck my phone out. I kept waiting for someone else to elbow me out of the way and no one did. And it just happened. And so
I think it's the only thing. It was just, it's one of those pictures that, yeah, maybe it's not a historical picture, but I think that it was one of the most sort of poignant examples of something that I've ever seen in my life personally. And I can relate with what Ryan was saying. It was a juxtaposition of two worlds that didn't seem like they should be colliding, but they were. And I will say, and I don't mean this in any way to make you feel bad, but it is the only thing that made me regret not going to that game last night was seeing that picture. And yeah, and it was because of seeing those worlds collide. So I really thought it was just an iconic picture. And man, that's awesome. I'm so happy that you had that experience.
Yeah, thanks. That was really cool. So enough about me. I didn't mean to take up that much time. It was great. And so let's go on to the other great thing, slightly more great, which was the game.
Yeah, we can stop patting ourselves on the back for a moment. The game itself, I was talking about this in the car. I was driving back from Schaumburg today, and I was talking to my wife, Kara, and I said, you know, I don't think in the moment I, and maybe most Cub fans, could really appreciate how well a played game that was from the Cubs' point of view. Mm-hmm. I mean, really, They couldn't have done much better in that game. There was, I'm sure everybody had their Cubsiety about what was going to happen and what might happen later in the game. And, oh, they're going to Chapman with five outs into the World Series. All these different kind of things that are tough to shake just because we're Cubs fans. But really, in retrospect, there was no moment of real anxiety in that game. There was no real question. The Dodgers never got the tying run on base. They never got the tying run on deck. I mean, not a single time in that game, really. So there was just nothing. It was just a perfect, well-played game.
I agree. I will just say this one thing. I did feel a little anxiety when Tolles led off with a sharp single on the first pitch. I was like, oh my God, what? How, already? And then on the next pitch, Seager grounded a double play. And it's like, okay, that's more like it. So there was that brief moment. But after that, you're right. I mean, no one reached second on the Dodgers. I think the entire game, right?
No, I don't. I think you're right. Correct. No one reached second. In fact, the Cubs as a team. Yeah, they faced the minimum, which is insane. I mean, every player that got on base was either in part of a double play or got picked off. So, and Kyle Hendricks, I think it's probably, rose-colored glasses to say that was the best game he's ever pitched as a Cub, but it's probably top five.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, I think the game that he took a no-hitter into the ninth this year was maybe his best game ever. I think that's the best stuff I've ever seen him have, but... other than that Andrew Tolles single in the first inning, which was not a rocket, but it was hit solidly, I don't think they hit the ball hard, other than maybe the error that Baez made. Everything else was a jam jobber off the end of the bat. It was really just
right.
It was definitely classic Hendricks, which was great. But I think you're right in that the game was a little bit odd because it was a game six at Wrigley Field, and I think all of us were kind of scratching a 13-year scab there, you know, from what we had seen in the game six against the Marlins in 2003. And even so, I couldn't muster up the anxiety that I had felt even at many other times during this playoffs. And my wife even said that. She said, you were just so calm. It's like you never even considered that they could lose. I said, well, I had considered it, but I really felt like this team was here for business and there was nothing other than business to get done. And it never felt like they were going to lose. Especially after the second pitch. Once they turned that double play, it was like, oh yeah, here we go, here we go. So I thought that Fowler, you know, leading off the hit, and then Bryant with just a beautiful at bat against Kershaw and taking that knee-high outside corner fastball to right field was just a beautiful piece of hitting and knocking Fowler in. And right then I thought, this game is over. They are going to win this game. So...
yeah, I didn't have quite that confidence. I was still pretty anxious into maybe the sixth inning or so. I think it was around Anthony Rizzo's home run that I felt, okay, they're really going to take this home, I think. You brought up, though, that Bryant at bat. I think it was more than this, just that at bat, too. I saw several times during the game, especially against Kershaw, that he was trying to take the fastball into right field. Mm-hmm. I think that's a really clear example of why we should have felt good about this game going against Kershaw in the first place, is that they just faced him a week ago. And this team does exactly what Bryant was doing there. He learned what Kershaw was trying to do to him. And he came in with a plan knowing what Kershaw was going to do. And it worked in the first inning. He lined that fastball in the outside corner to right field for a base hit. Mm-hmm. I want to say in his next at bat, he had a line drive to right field, but Puig was right there. So
yeah, right at him.
Yeah, I mean, it was Bryant. I wrote this in my player analysis on Bryant, is that he ended up 1-for-4, but the process was beautiful. I mean, he did exactly what you would want your player to do in that position. I think probably up and down the lineup, you had a whole bunch of guys who figured out what Kershaw was trying to do to them and what he did well to them in game two. And, you know, he figured it out. They all figured it out and did it back to him.
Yeah, not to just overly laud Bryant here, who's going to be the eventual MVP, but I also felt a real steadiness from him on defense on a couple of those balls hit a little bit harder to the left side. This is something I'm stunned that in his second year I'm saying, but the defensive presence that he brings to the field is quite impressive, and it's not something I really ever expected him to have. But he's not Javier Baez, where he's going to make plays that just make your jaw drop, like that play against Adrian Gonzalez on in game five. But he is a bit of a vacuum over there on the left side. And I on multiple occasions, you know, I saw decently struck balls, and he thought, oh, that might get through. And then the second you saw Brian over there, it was just your heart relaxed. And that was just something I noted in yesterday's game that I hadn't really felt before.
Yeah, that was, I think, something that people had some reservations about. They're like, well, he's what is he, 6'5"?
Yeah.
You know, they're like, he's big and he's graceful, but he's probably not going to be at third base for too long. And I think that, you know, I know that Isaac, you've written about Hendricks, and now he's been proving people wrong at every level, whereas Bryant has just, you know, he's done what people thought and then exceeded it. And that's what, you know, that's what you've seen at third base too. It's like he's done as well as people thought his rookie year, and now he's just exceeded it as a obviously plus defender. And I think you're probably gonna see him there for the most part going forward, except, you know, when he plays left field, although there was some left field news last night. So I don't know how much we want to get into that. We can wait on that a little bit, I suppose. But
I think Hendricks requires some conversation, like you're saying there.
Yeah, I agree.
I
wanted to go more on Hendricks. I feel like his control was as pinpoint as I have ever seen it. And a really great point that I think was made before the game. He absolutely excels when he hits more than 4 days of rest. And I think this was on 5 days of rest for him. So I think that, and maybe it was Alex Rodriguez who pointed it out in the pregame, said Kershaw, on the other hand, does not do as well on more than 4 days. He does better on 4 or even 3 days, whereas Hendricks on more than 4 days rest has just been amazing in his career. So I think that's a really great thing to look at going forward, and how they align their rotation in the World Series, which is difficult to even get those words out of my mouth. And yeah, I mean, there was just Hendricks had everything going last night, and his calm confidence and his demeanor was just 100% tailored for that situation. He is going to go down, I think, in his career as the kind of guy we look back on, kind of like Lackey and Lester, and say, well, that's the dude you want in your elimination game.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because I was looking back on last night's game, and the fourth inning, Tolles was kind of a thorn in the Cubs' side this series. And so in the top of the fourth, he led off with a fly to deep right, which again, he got some decent distance on that. And so I was like, well, you know, we're starting to get a little bit into the game. Maybe Hendricks is getting a little tired. And then on a 2-0 count to Seager, there he grounded out weakly to Hendricks. And then Turner, on a 1-2 count, grounded out to Rizzo at first. And Rizzo had to take like 3 steps and walk over and touch the base. And the inning was over. And it just was so, like, they were going down so meekly. I mean, it wasn't just, you know, they weren't getting up there and swinging and missing ridiculous amount of times, that they just seemed to have no clue against him. And it was just so beautiful to watch. I couldn't, you know, I was watching it live, so I couldn't see exactly what you guys could see at home, but it just seemed like they were just so befuddled and they just didn't know what to do with him.
Yeah, and Hendricks, it's interesting because I thought last night was a microcosm of his career, which was essentially getting overshadowed at every turn that he has and outperforming the things that are overshadowing him. I mean, coming into this season, he was obviously the Cubs' fifth starter, but the reality was he was probably better than that, you know, even before this. It was the constant battle of, is he the guy that his peripheral numbers say they are, which I will remind people are still very good, or is he the guy that his in-game results say that he is? And I've made cases on here and other places that he is much better than his peripheral results suggest, because he can pitch to his defense so effectively and he can hit his spots so effectively. But last night, my friend Jeremy Beidel tweeted out that he found the very first G-Chat conversation we'd had about Hendricks, which was us discussing how angry we were that he didn't make ML or Cubs.com's top prospect list, top 30 prospects. And I remember that conversation. It was over 3 years ago, saying basically, this is ridiculous. They're only scouting things that he doesn't do well, rather than focusing on the things that he does do well. So he's kind of always been our guy. And to see him go out and have that performance and beat the best pitcher on the planet, probably the the best or one of the very best lefties of all time. See him just totally outduel him on the biggest possible stage was personally rewarding. And I know it had to be so incredibly rewarding for Kyle Hendricks. And, you know, it was just one of those things that I won't forget. And I won't forget that it was that guy on the mound. And I like what Ryan said about saying, hey, we're going to look through his career and say, man, that guy's stoic nature and his, you know, just kind of cold-blooded killer sort of approach is, it's the guy. It's the guy we want out there. So I love seeing him, you know, outduel sort of the Goliath and Clayton Kershaw and playing the David role. So thank you, Kyle Hendricks. That was amazing.
Yeah. He even throughout the game was dealing with the underestimating. Joel, you wouldn't have heard this, but I'm sure Isaac, you were like wanting to rip your hair out hearing John Smoltz, who I like at times, especially when he's breaking down pitchers and pitching. I really enjoy, but at other times is just terrible. And he was saying, like throughout the entire game, more than once, that he thought that no matter what, Joe Maddon should get him out before the sixth inning. And even when they were getting toward the sixth inning, he's like, yeah, well, he's got to get him out of here soon. And we're looking at, I mean, at this point, he's saying it, and it's like sixth inning, and Hendricks has thrown like 52 pitches.
And one, like one base runner.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. He allowed it to be a lot of base. Yeah, he allowed a base hit on the first pitch of the game, and since that moment, he hadn't allowed anything. He had been dominating the Dodgers. Like, this is not a guy who went five innings every game all year. This is a guy who, you know, frequently went six, and at occasionally went seven, eight, nine. I mean,
yeah, that was bad.
I couldn't. Yeah, it was a really, it was a national stupid moment. I mean, I do like Smoltz the way he breaks down pitching, but you have to know a little bit more than that. I mean, this is. There's a reason that this guy led the major leagues in ERA, and there's a reason he was the number two starter ahead of the 2015 Cy Young winner.
Yeah, I felt like he read a scouting report from 18 months ago and was like, oh, okay, he struggles the third time through the order. I'm going to make sure I focus on that. Failing to realize that he obliterated the league in ERA and failing to realize that he was just completely befuddling, like Joel said, the Dodgers lineup. So it was like, are you watching the game, John? But I'll forgive him for it. He's a national guy. It was just, it was one of those reasons I had to mute him and turn Pat back on. So, but yeah. You know what? I won't let it detract from the night.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there's really, like Ryan said, I mean, there's almost, I mean, it couldn't have gone easier. It couldn't have gone better. I mean, it's like once they, when they played it two, it's funny, when they played it two in the first, I was like, this is good, but three would have been really nice, you know? And then, you know, when they, when Fowler drove in, no, Fowler scored, no, Fowler drove in Russell, sorry, that's what so little sleep will get you. Then he got thrown out. Fowler got thrown out there. At first, I was like, oh, man, maybe that could have been a bigger inning. But, you know, then they're up 3-0. And then you just never felt like after – well, clearly, it was never in any danger. There was never any danger that the Dodgers were just going to, you know, mound anything. And Hendricks just kept them so off balance. And it was beautiful because it wasn't like a Kerry Wood dominating performance with, you know, 14 strikeouts. It was just a guy really artfully working it and making them look silly. And it was great. Mm.
You know, and before we start going, looking ahead at the World Series and that other big topic we wanted to talk about, I wanted to bring up, And this is just personally for me, and I know probably for you guys too, if you noticed it or thought about it, but there was some symbolic significance late in the game, and that is when Hendricks came out with the runner on first base with five outs before the Cubs could advance to the World Series. Chapman gets a really hard hit, well played double play ball. Right to Javier Baez, and they turn the double play beautifully and get out of the inning. It felt like there was symbolic weight lifted in that moment. Like that was some kind of mental hurdle and in no way for this team, because I don't think they know or care. But I think for fans, that moment was the ultimate, like, okay,
yeah,
the ghosts of the past are gone. They were five outs away, and they just turned a really awesome double play. And then again in the ninth inning, the game ending on a ground ball to the shortstop for the easy perfect turn double play. I mean, that it just felt like so much weight lifted in a symbolic way.
I agree. And to be honest, sorry, go ahead, Joel.
No, you go first. You're going ahead. Go for it.
Oh, I was just going to say, I actually despise the symbolism around the Cubs, and I don't like the celebrity scene and the national focus on the celebrity scene. And I've always felt like the symbolic nature was negative, and it should have necessarily been, because there's so much great sort of history around this team and the stadium, and yet everything that was talked about from a symbolic nature was always negative. So I felt the same, and I felt that burden lifting, and I thought it was interesting that Chapman did give up such hard contact, but it turned into a double play. And like you said, that was just a sort of a break-free moment. And I hope that this fan base and the national narrative surrounding the team can get beyond sort of all the sort of ridiculous garbage, mystical kind of curse type stuff, because it's been such a drag on life and on the fandom of this team. So let's just move beyond it once and for all.
Yeah, you
in
know,
the eighth inning. Sorry, I have to get this out there before you respond, Joel, because I would love to hear your thought on this. In the eighth inning, when the Cubs up 5-0 and looking like they're about to roll to the World Series, Joe Buck tosses it down to Tom Verducci to talk about the goddamn goat.
Oh, seriously.
I heard about that. I heard about
that. So dumb.
It's like my brain was about to explode. I think he even tweeted is like, and now with the NLCS about to end and the Cubs about to make history, let's cut to Tom Verducci for another story about stupid farm animals.
So dumb. I it was shame on
that's
them.
Embarrassing. I mean, shame on them. That's dumb. Really. Yeah, that's embarrassing.
And even Joe Buck thought it was stupid. Like, you could hear it in his voice. He's like, yeah, and Cubs fans don't really like hearing about this. And he said that several times. Like, yeah, the fans don't really want to hear about this anymore. Yeah, nobody wants to hear about it because nobody cares about the goddamn goat.
Seriously. Yeah.
I mean, I wonder, I know that they feel like they kind of have to do that because it's national, it's the narrative, but I wonder how much, you know, it was like the curse of the Bambino. You know, Dan Shaughnessy beat that to death. But did anyone give a shit about that? I mean, really? Like, I mean, I'm a baseball fan. I'm outside Boston. I don't care. I don't believe in any of that stuff. Come on. So I don't know. I don't know who they're feeding it to. Like, who is like, hey, you know, what I'd really like to hear about is what about that goat? Like, who is thinking that anywhere?
I think that's
self-propagating. Anyway, but back to your point, Ryan, about the exercising the ghosts of 2003 in the eighth inning. You're completely right, because you know, you're in the eighth inning and you're up 5-0. You're feeling pretty good about it, and then so after one out, Gonzalez flies out, and then right, like, me and like four guys all around me turn to each other, like simultaneously, just spontaneously. It's like, this is it. This is the play right here. And then, on the, what was the count? It was the first pitch, Reddick singles. It's like, son of a bitch. Like, you know, I mean, I didn't believe that, you know, there was any sort of residual curse or anything, but you were like, man, it would have been really nice if this would just go cleanly. But then there you go, double play on an 0-2 count to Howie Kendrick. And then it was over. And you're like, and it was the same with the last out. I don't know if I want to, if it's okay if I jump ahead to the last out. But, you know, when Ruiz walked, you know, I didn't feel like the game was in doubt. But, you know, you kind of want Chapman to be a little cleaner. And I have a theory as to why Madden put him in the eighth inning, by the way, because I wasn't in favor of that. No one around me was in favor of that. And I don't know how you guys feel about it, but
I do not like it.
I think you do know how we feel about it.
Yeah. But you know, so then you had a sharp grounder to Russell, and he threw it to Baez, I feel like with more velocity than he usually throws. And it was like, oh, that's great. There's two outs. And it's like, and it happened in slow motion. It's like, wait a second. This might be a double. This could be the end of it's over, you know, because it first, I didn't immediately think double play. I don't know what you guys thought. And it was like, and suddenly it was over. And then it was bedlam and, you know, elation and euphoria. And it was amazing.
I was trying to plan ahead. The way I have to watch games when I'm writing is, if there's a runner on first with only one out, I have to plan in my mind that the next swing could end the inning. And when I saw the swing from Puig and I saw the way the ball chopped, Even before they changed camera angles to Addison Russell, I was thinking double play. And I mean, I hate to keep going back to the 0-3 play, but in my mind, I'm picturing the way he's fielding the ball and just the position on the field and the ball, the way it was hit. I mean, it just, it reminded me so much of that play, the way he turned it.
That's an interesting point, but you're right. Yeah.
I mean, it was like almost exact same spot on the field, I feel like. So yeah, it was just this seminal moment in the game and in Cubs history, watching that double play get turned. That, yeah, I mean, and just hearing, I mean, you can say what you want about Joe Buck, but congrats to him on letting the moment be the moment and not trying to be the moment himself. After the ball got to first base, he just said the Cubs have won the pennant, and then he went silent for like 2 minutes.
Yeah, so Pat Hughes did the same thing, and I found it interesting, and I felt like there was maybe even some coordination in that, just to let it breathe. And I felt like, you know, we're talking about all of these things and breaking curses and 71-year droughts and hopefully an 108-year drought coming up as well, but five starters, 24 years old or younger, and the narrative surrounding that last night was, well, these kids are so young, they don't know what the moment is. Baloney. I was so mad about that. A kid does not stamp the MLB tattoo on the back of his neck at 16 years old if he doesn't full well know what that moment is. And you have to hand it to them even more for the fact that they are so young and they do understand the moment, and it didn't faze them. Russell and Baez up the middle turning double plays, and Bryant just that steadying presence over there at third, and Rizzo hitting an absolute bomb to right field. It was just like, they know what this moment is. They simply don't care about your grandfather's goat. They don't. So take it home and eat it like it's supposed to be eaten. So nice. I just loved it. I loved the call all the way around. I love Pat Hughes' call. And it was, the moment was everything and more that I dreamt that it could be. And we just need four more, man. Just need four more.
Yeah.
Well, with that, we should talk about those four more.
Let's do it.
The Cubs are going to be playing the Cleveland Indians, and because of Bud Selig and his moronic decision to make the All-Star game mean something, the 103-win Cubs will be the road team opening, and if it goes all seven, in four of the seven games against the, 94-win Cleveland Indians? I think that's about right. He's 94 or 91. So the Cubs will open in Cleveland on Tuesday at 7 o'clock Central Time. And the starter, I'm guessing, for the Cubs will be John Lester on 4 days rest. That's only a guess. As we were talking, I noticed a notification on my phone. The Indians have set their first three as Corey Kluber, then Trevor Bauer, then Josh Tomlin in game three. So game one, Kluber against, I assume, Lester. Any thoughts on who might be DHing in that game for the Cubs?
Man, you know, we Joel and I actually recorded a quick hit yesterday to discuss this, and then we had some technical difficulties getting it up. So we actually discussed
Kyle. You usually do.
Yeah, we do. We had Kyle Schwarber, discussed him at length. And I guess the long short of it is we don't believe that they would be sending him to the Arizona Fall League if they didn't think that he could come back and be ready for this series. And a scout that was there watching yesterday basically said, you know what? Physically, he looks fine. The bat speed looks fine. It's all about whether or not he can regain his timing. So I think that there's a better than odds on chance that Kyle Schwarber is on this roster come tomorrow.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think that there is an 80% chance Schwarber is on the roster for the NL or for the World Series. And I agree. I talked to a few people. Basically, what I've heard from people and from Theo Epstein quotes and from Schwarber quotes is that he went last Monday and had his 6-month checkup and basically got full clearance from his doctor and said, "You're ready to go." In an interview after the game, in the Fall League game, he basically said he doesn't really have limitations on what his knee can do. He doesn't worry about running. He doesn't worry about any of that stuff. He basically said physically he's ready to be playing baseball. This isn't, you know, I've made, and I've heard other people make, you know, oh, you can picture like the Kirk Gibson moment where he's limping around the bases. That won't be it. You'll be getting Kyle Schwarber. If he hits a home run in a game, he's going to be sprinting full speed, doing, you know, the Kyle Schwarber run. I mean, this guy is physically he's ready. The question, as you said it, it's 100% timing. The Cubs kept it under their hat. He was taking live batting practice off fall league pitchers of their own. They sent him to the game because they wanted to see him in game. And Theo Epstein drunkenly said on MLB Network at about 1 a.m. that Kyle Schwarber looked good. He was out in front of some off-seed stuff, but as far as everything physically and everything with his bat, they think he stopped short of saying he's going to be on the roster, but he made it sound like it's pretty much a done thing.
Yeah. It's really exciting news. And the thing is though, is that, you know, this, the, as I said, yeah, it's funny, Isaac, because I'm worried about repeating myself. Then I realized that that quick hit didn't go up. So I'm not repeating myself, just to you. So you can go back to watching kitten videos. but you know, this front office does not do things for, you know, touchy-feely reasons. You know, it's a great story, but they don't care about stories. They don't care about narratives. I mean, I think that they appreciate that it does make a nice story, and I think it does give the team a little bit of a boost, but they wouldn't put him in this position and they wouldn't have announced it and they wouldn't have made this move if he wasn't ready to go. And because they're smart and they don't do things for dumb reasons, you know? And so I have pretty much full confidence that we're going to see him. And, you know, I know that the naysayers are saying, well, you know, he's hasn't faced live pitching in months, and, you know, a couple games in the AFL are not the same as, you know, facing Corey Kluber, but, you know, he's a hitter, capital H. And I think that he strikes a little fear into other pitchers. And I think having him back is huge. You know, with the way that Contreras has been hitting, and Russell was coming back around, and Rizzo was coming back around. If you add and Fowler, and if you add Schwarber to this, you know, I mean, that's a murderer's row. That is just an amazing, considering that the Indians offense really struggled in the playoffs. I mean, it just makes me feel pretty optimistic.
You said that Kyle Schwarber is a capital H hitter, and that is true. And so that actually sort of usurps the next point I'm going to make. However, the Indians' first three starters are all right-handed, which on the surface makes you think, well, great, Schwarber's a perfect guy to put in here. But what's interesting is that both Josh Tomlin and Trevor Bauer have fairly severe reverse splits, and they're actually more effective against lefties than they are against righties. Corey Kluber right. This year, over his career, he's been normal splits, but this year he's actually been very neutral, where lefties and righties have been almost exactly the same. And his pitch mix has actually changed a little bit this year to that effect. He wanted to be more effective against lefties, and he's done that well. But Tomlin and Bauer both are way more effective against lefties than they are righties. How does that affect your guys' feeling of getting Schwarber in there? Or is he just such a presence and such a hitter that you don't really care? Just throw him in there, hit in fifth, and DH him and pinch hit him late in the games in the NL Park. What's your thought there?
I think that you put him in there, maybe bat him sixth, and let him DH. And I wrote something about Hayward this week, where I looked at the potential World Series matchups and saw the same thing. Tomlin specifically has a curveball that is just nasty against left-handed hitters. I think they were hitting 128 against it this year. So I don't think any of that matters in this moment. I think he, if he's healthy, is one of your best hitters, and you can't look past the opportunity to get him in the lineup without having to make him worry about fielding. And if you can get his timing at the plate and his knee is really, truly healthy and he's feeling it, you know, I don't know. Maybe you have the conversation about him spending some time in the outfield in games 3, 4, 5. Ooh. I don't know if you go that far. It's
wow.
I mean, if you're hiding him in left field, you know, maybe you tell him, don't go, you know, don't overextend yourself. But I don't know. The line's just drawn naturally for me. If it really is and this is what he's said, and his doctor and Theo Epstein have all said in the last couple of days, if it really is that his knee is fully healthy and he's ready to go, he should be out there kind of, you know, doing some left field drills and just getting prepared, get him in the lineup for the first two games as a DH, and then see where you are. See if you're ready to to go out in left field for 5 or 6 innings.
Wow.
Well, yeah, I think it's a fair point that it's not Kirk Gibson. It has that feel because he hasn't played in 7 months, but the guy is healthy. He's, you know, I would call it a semi-world-class athlete, and he's healthy. His knee's healthy. He's been cleared. He's ready to go. And you know what? Man, maybe you're right. Maybe especially against Kluber, if you get Kluber in a game 4 or 5 in Wrigley, it's going to be really tempting since he doesn't have the reverse split like the other two guys. Maybe you do run him out there in left field. It's something to consider. And I think that probably depends on what his at-bats look like in games 1 and 2 with the assumption that he's on the team. If he looks good in games 1 and 2, it's going to be really hard to keep him out of the lineup.
Right. Especially if he's telling you, there's a video that I watched on somebody who was in the Arizona Fall League who was covering it for The Athletic, where he interviewed Schwarber after the game, where he basically just, he crapped all over anyone trying to say this is about his knee. He just said, no, my knee is fine. You won't see me limping out there. I'm going to be running. It's all about timing at this point. So, yeah, you're right. If he goes out there and in the first 2 games as a DH, assuming he's actually on the roster, if he goes, you know, 4 for 8 with a home run and 2 doubles, you're going to be questioning, well, if he says his knee's all right, why can't he go out to the left field for 5 or 6 innings and then get a defensive replacement? But outside of Schwarber, which is still a question in the air, we're getting kind of giddy about it because it's just, you're right. You make the point about how it is a sentimental story and they wouldn't do it for that reason, but it just furthers the script of what an amazing season this has been. If they can get Schwarber back in the lineup, and you dream about Schwarber being World Series MVP and, you know, all these things, it really is fun to talk about. The World Series outside of that is happening. The Cubs are going to be playing World Series games at Wrigley Field this week. And that is just beyond comprehension for me right now still.
I think I'm with you.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine. But, you know, I mean, it's like which manager came off and their first press conference said, why not us? I want to say it was Madden, but I feel like it might have been Pinella, actually. But it's like, why not
that
us?
Was, you know? I think it was Dusty Baker, actually. I think Dusty said, why not us?
But, you know, he was right. And why not us? You know, this is a major market team, and they've finally got a smart front office, and it's time. And we're ready, and I think the team is ready. So I couldn't be more excited, and I look forward to the days when we're like, yeah, remember when it was weird for the Cubs to make the World Series?
Now they have 5 and 6 years.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
What happened in that 1 year?
Yeah, Isaac, Mr. Negative.
I can't come up with anything. You're right. Six years.
Yeah. Work stoppage.
Yeah, work stoppage. I love it. Oh, heaven forbid I would not survive.
All right. Before we go into our predictions for the series and a short little segment I wanted to do, Isaac, do you have an at-bat of the NLCS for us?
I do have an at-bat of the NLCS, and I think it's actually a fairly obvious one. And I'm going to reach out to our lost Guatemalan brother, Carlos Porto Carrero here. I'm not sure he ever made it back last night from partying in Wrigleyville. So wherever you are out there, face down in the ditch, Carlos, buddy, we miss you and love you. So in game 4, the Cubs were down 2-1, and I think our souls were hurting. We were feeling the trepidation of a possibly blown NLCS. The Cubs had not scored in 21 going on 22 innings, and we're trailing 2-1 and had absolutely nothing going for themselves from an offensive standpoint. To lead off the top of the 4th inning in a 0-0 game, Eureka native and a guy that I know, Ben Zobrist, led off the top of the 4th inning with a perfectly placed bunt single down the 3rd baseline. And he started off a 4-1 rally, which saw Javier Baez single, Contreras single, and Addison Russell hit a 2-run homer to center for a 4-run rally that the Cubs never, ever looked back from. From that moment on, they outscored the opposition. Oh, man, what was it? 18, it would have been like 23-5 or something like that. 23-6, I think. So that bunt really just changed the entire momentum of the series and started the Cubs off on a crazy offensive run. So Ben Zobrist, bunt single, top of the 4th inning in game 4. You get the at-bat of the NLCS.
A guy that you know? What? Now, yeah, Joel's bestie is Wilson Contreras, and yours is Ben Zobrist, huh?
Yeah, I mean, he's from the adjacent town. I actually played against him in high school. I think I've told that story on here, but
I don't remember.
Yeah, I actually played against his brother last year in adult league. He pitched last year against in one of the teams. So their family's huge. My wife knows him really well. So
I don't know, Ryan. I feel like I'm being big timed a little bit. How do you feel?
I think so too. Yeah. Maybe I should break out my Sean Livingston stories.
No,
played against each other in seventh and eighth grade, and it's a guy I know.
He took him off the dribble a couple times. I don't doubt.
I guarded him on defense. I held him to only 8 points. He wasn't much of a shooter back then.
But. In 6 minutes.
I was going to say something like that, but.
All right. So before we go to predictions, I wanted to do this outside of just the winning of the NLCS, which I think is a cop out. Give me your one moment where you felt like the biggest high in the NLCS. Man.
I'm going to go with Fowler's lead. Well, I mean, it's either Fowler's double or Brian's single to drive him in. I just felt I would say it was Fowler's double, because when he let off, I'm like, oh man, they're going to score and they're going to take a lead. And every championship LCS game in the American League and the National League, the team that scored first won. So I just felt like I knew he was going to score. And so when he reached off Kershaw, I thought they're going to score, and that could mean that they'll win. So that was the biggest thing for me.
I guess I would kind of delineate between the crockpot slow burn and the most rewarding thing, I think, over the course of a game was Hendricks dominating, just personally. But for a single moment, I think the most ecstasy I felt was when Russell hit the 2-run homer in that same inning as Zobrist's bunt to make it 4-0, because it sort of like cemented that game. And I spent I was writing the recap that game for Wrigleyville, and I spent a full 10 seconds staring at the TV going, did that ball just seriously go over the fence in center field? That easy power from that beautiful man. But when it hit me that it was 4-0 and they were going to tie this thing up at 2-2, and it was Addison Russell, you know, in that moment, I just screamed at the top of my lungs for about 10 full seconds. And it was like such a ridiculous release of tension and anxiety and everything else. And I'll stop making this sound quite so, you know, but that for me, I think, was the moment of most joy and ecstasy in the NLCS.
My moment was actually the game I was at, which was game one. And it was after the Dodgers had tied it at 3 in the bottom of the eighth inning, the Cubs had loaded the bases, mostly due to Dave Roberts being an idiot and intentionally walking Chris Coughlin and Jason Hayward to allow Joe Blanton, who doesn't even have a fastball, who only basically throws breaking balls, to pitch to Miguel Montero, who cannot hit a fastball and can only hit a spinning breaking ball. And it's an 0-2 pitch, and I decide to pull out my phone to shoot a video of the next pitch. And I have no idea why I did that, probably because I was like 8 beers deep at that point. But I just decided that was the moment I wanted to shoot a video. And I caught Montero hitting that hanging breaking ball, just lining it into right field for a grand slam, and then getting beer dumped on me, just like directly on top of my head, just soaked. And it was just the greatest moment. It's the best I've ever felt at a Cubs game in my life, just from, you know, watching John Lester dominate and the Cubs not do anything on offense, and then the Dodgers come back and tie it, and then the Cubs just have the most unlikely moment possible. Miguel Montero, 0-2, 2-out grand slam.
Yeah, that's
pretty nice. That was a good one. I terrified a couple of tables of people in Miami when I smacked the table and screamed, and I was looked at as a crazy person, and that's okay.
Yeah, they were right to do so. But not specifically because of that.
Yeah, it was totally unrelated.
All right, so predictions. Joel, what are you predicting for the World Series?
Cubs in 5.
All right, Isaac?
I sort of hate this optimism, but Cubs in 5. I think they wrap it up at home, and I just think the Cubs are quite a bit better. Indians are hot, but it's baseball, and I think the Cubs are quite a bit better. Cubs in 5.
Just to be different, I'm going to say Cubs in six. I was tempted to say Cubs in four, but I can't do it. I just can't say it. I want to say it, but I can't. So Cubs in six. I think, yeah, we'll be spared. We'll be spared the joy of clinching at Wrigley Field, but they'll still do it. So Cubs in six.
Yeah, we're not being homers, right? I mean, this is sound, logical, rational thinking. That they're not like, you know, a lucky team that scrapped its way here. They're the better team.
And I don't think anyone will disagree with that. With that, we'll wrap it up. Good night, everybody.